this week's episode of Media Voices. I'm your host, Chris Sutcliffe.
I'm Esther Thorpe.
And I'm Peter Houston.
Later this episode, you're going to be hearing from Lucy Kung. Lucy's a hugely well-respected professor and expert on strategy, innovation, and leadership, with a particular emphasis on managing technological shifts. And she's a visiting fellow at the Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism, among many, many other places. And I spoke to her about the journalism industry's perverse fascination with Silicon Valley and asked her what, if anything, legacy news publishers can learn from the new tech giants as they struggle to cross what she describes as the Valley of Death. Ahead of that, though, the news roundup. And the controversial EU copyright directive has been approved, and if it gets through the next stages, could be more disruptive for publishers and media orgs than GDPR. Now, who's saying it's going to be more disruptive?
Me.
Go on, why?
I mean, GDPR has been hugely disruptive, as we all know, but this almost, if it gets through, it would fundamentally alter the way people collect and kind of curate and publish content. And, you know, it's one thing to legislate the data you have and the consumers you have and the way you monetize that. It's another to then kind of go for the content itself. But there are good and bad things, and kind of what they're trying to redress is good.
For people who haven't necessarily looked into the details of this, Article 13, which is one of the pieces of this legislature that have been passed, is the meme tax, effectively, right? This is the one that prevents any use of copyrighted materials.
Well, I mean, even Article 11 falls under what they're trying to do is, the Verge has got a really good explain, I think we should link to, which is that...
We can't, we'll have to pay this link tax.
Not yet. The Verge says that both measures are trying to kind of redress an imbalance at the core of the contemporary web. We all know about this. Facebook and Google make vast amounts of money by providing access to material made by other people and publishers, while those making the content, like, you know, music, movies, books, journalism, content creators, publishers, all that, they kind of get like an ever shrinking slice of the pies.
So it's really about forcing these platforms which have benefited from other content creators to pay a fair amount for use of it, which presumably is why Jimmy Wales and YouTube and Facebook are notably against it, because their business model sort of relies on that.
Putting Jimmy Wales and YouTube and Facebook in the same basket there, man, get a grip.
Well, they're all against it.
Yeah, but that's a bit like, well, I'll struggle for an analogy that doesn't involve Hitler and Stalin, but... And some other nice person.
That is the fastest we've ever got to Hitler on an episode of Media Voices.
What's that called? Godwin's Law?
Godwin's Law.
Anyway, my point with that is he's against it because Wikipedia is a public good, largely a public good. And if he's getting taxed for linking out to articles that explain the birth of democracy in Greece, you know, in the same basket as YouTube getting taxed for stealing movie trailers, that's bullshit. No, they're against it for different reasons.
Yeah.
One person's against it because it damages humanity's quest for knowledge. The other people are against it because they're rapacious capitalist bastards trying to make as much money as they possibly can without spending any money.
Well, I mean, at this point, we don't even know how any of this is going to be implemented. So it being sort of an EU directive, all that means is it's for the individual member states to actually decide how they implement it. There's a really good article on Shortlist, actually. Elena Kresge explains how this might actually be put into effect. And interestingly, has, you know, how similar legislature has had a cooling effect on creativity to date.
But I think in some ways this is needed. So I just want to rewind a little bit and say that actually, so there are two main articles that are kind of really causing concern here. One is that Article 11, which is the link tax, where publishers can demand license payments when companies like Google link to their stories. And that is like a whole can of worms in itself. And then Article 13 is like, it wants to kind of stop sites like YouTube and Facebook just get having users upload content that doesn't belong to them. So they almost want them to scan it against a database of copyrighted material. Now, as you may or may not know, I went viral last week.
Are you willing? You're finally willing to talk about that?
You've outed yourself as a viral star.
And what I found really, really interesting was the way different publishers handled this, because some of them took screenshots of the tweet itself, you know, with the caption, which was half of what the funny bit was anyway. And there were others that literally just pinched the picture. And what bugged me is that there was no way to say to these online meme outlets, you know, all these pages on Facebook that just took the picture and put their own caption. It was like, no, that's my photograph. You've taken it, you've redistributed it in a completely different way to the way I originally intended. And I'm getting absolutely nothing from this. I made zero out of, like, what was it, like 35,000 likes or something ridiculous? Whereas, you know, these meme pages are gaining likes, they're gaining advertising revenue. They kind of get all that stuff, and it's like, well, that's not fair on me. Okay, I have a tiny little violin here.
So there's so much to thrash out here. I mean, the Tech Dirt is reporting that even the guy in charge of it, Voss, admitted afterwards that he hadn't actually known what he'd voted on when it came to Article 12, and that, quote, this was kind of a mistake, and that, quote, no one had been aware of this. I feel like if you're going to vote on something, you should probably have been aware of it. See also Brexit.
I don't think this is necessarily a bad thing. I just think it's another example of trying to legislate something that's fundamentally unlegislatable.
Yeah. Yeah, the fact that people are now calling it the destruction of the open web, and it's going to have such a profound effect if implemented badly on everything from, you know, Reddit to the ability of smaller publishers to monetize.
We need like a big doom chiming bell there. It's like bong.
So the BBC has decided that it's launching a weekly news show, that's its own kettle of worms, on Facebook Watch in the US.
I put in the slightly UKIP comment. How is this being funded? British taxpayers? No, it's probably more likely Facebook's chucking a ton of money at it, but I couldn't find out. So they're launching this show on Facebook Watch in the US specifically, even though Facebook Watch is allegedly now worldwide. It's called Cut Through the Noise, and it's going to be like the first... It's going to be the first news program that Facebook show on this. And weirdly, it's like made for mobile. So they're kind of doing it like vertical video first, and they're kind of going to focus on tackling a different issue each week. I don't get why they do this in the US. Like, if Facebook Watch is coming to the UK, why not just hold out until we can actually all see the button and then do it there? I don't know.
Well, Jim Egan, CEO of BBC Global News, has said that this is almost explicitly for Americans. He says, social media is an important source of news and information for many Americans, so we are always looking for new ways of bringing our audiences high-quality, non-partisan news coverage they can trust from around the world. And, you know, in the sense that the BBC actually does have relatively high trust indexes globally, maybe this is a good idea that they can actually go in there with kind of a impartiality remit, just as they have in the UK.
An extension of British soft power.
So, I mean, do we think this is going to work? Because Facebook Watch has released some stats that kind of show the extent to which it has been rolled out.
Isn't this one of those things that... So Facebook Watch wasn't available in the UK. Someone at the BBC months and months and months ago said, oh, we should try this. So the only way they could try it was in the US. So they've done it in the US just to see how it works, because that was the only place you could do it. It's a time lag thing.
It's a pilot scheme, you think, that just happens to be US-centric.
Esther's making faces and funny noises, so...
It would be nice to see a publisher really go for Facebook Watch that has the pressure to monetize it. What the BBC won't worry about is, oh, wait, how are we making money from the adverts? How are we making money? Like, how are we going to distribute this and make it work for us? So I do feel if Facebook have got them on board and are pushing money towards them, I just feel like it's a tiny bit exploitative.
But it depends if it's under BBC Worldwide. Is that's got commercial imperatives?
Yeah, there's a few wings of the BBC that actually have, you know, the remit to go out and seek commercial revenue, and this seems like it might well be part of that.
This is the thing, there's no information on how any funding is going or where it's coming from or what their goals are for this.
Yeah.
So I'm just a little bit. I'm not holding out on agreeing that this is a brilliant thing yet.
But what it definitely is evidence of is kind of continued investment in Facebook Watch from Facebook.
Oh yeah, but they'll carry on investment until what, this time next year, and then they'll dial it down.
How incredibly cynical.
Can I just say as well that Cut Through the Noise is the most BBC title that I think I've ever heard.
Do you know what? Do you know, as soon as I heard that, I thought of the Slade song.
So, ironically, a YouGov survey came out this week showing that half of Brits are worried about the rising US dominance in UK media. Now, this is a weird one, because what was the methodology behind this? How do you actually measure whether people who are largely unaware of who owns what is worried about stuff?
What was the actual question? It's like, are you worried about US dominance in UK media? Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Well, it seems to be that it's very advertising specific, this one. It seems that it was mainly based on people are worried that they are going to see less relevant advertising.
I don't think I've ever met anyone who is worried about seeing less advertising.
No, less relevant advertising. So more increasing the volume of it, but less relevant. So almost,
because advertising on the web is so relevant already.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'm still getting chased around the web by a bunch of, you know, a pair of boots that I bought for my girlfriend back in about 2015.
But then I think, like, there's a piece by The Drum that points out that actually that's, people may worry about that, but we do have Ofcom in this country who have quite strict controls on advertising, the volume of it. So The Drum basically said, like, these fears aren't always based on fact.
What? British public fears not based on fact? How could that possibly be?
So when I kind of, when I initially saw this and initially read this, I thought actually probably what a lot of this stems from is the fact that the British media is focused so much, rightly or wrongly, on things like Trump, the American economy, you know, the storms hitting America. And it does feel a little bit like there's been so much US-related stuff in the headlines. I think people maybe just got a little bit like confused about it. You could
they
be
want
doing
British news for British people.
you're British. Why didn't you do a British accent when you said that? I don't understand.
What kind of accent did you think it was? It's a weird one, though, because, you know, you think podcasts is a great example of this. I listen to a bunch of podcasts sponsored by a bunch of companies that I can't buy from.
Yeah. Now, there's an insane amount of news that actually came out from the media industry this week. So let's just rattle through some of the bigger ones. Reach, which used to be known as Trinity Mirror, is about to cut 70 jobs across the Mirror and Express newspapers and shut weekly celebrity magazine Star as part of ongoing cost-cutting efforts following the takeover earlier in the year. Though that kind of consolidation of staff isn't necessarily unexpected. You know, we saw that The Guardian and The Observer had to do it.
It's an interesting one because there's still this whole Mirror Express thing that Simon Fox, I guess, was saying they're going to remain editorially. Well, that's a hard phrase. They're going to remain editorially independent, but, you know, they're going to share content on things like sports or book or film reviews. And it's like, well, I hope no one ever writes a book about what a shit show Brexit's been, because because then the Express can't run it.
Speaking of job cuts, though, God, that's become a familiar phrase. Meredith has announced 200 job cuts and is going to be combining Cooking Light and Eating Well titles. And Esther, you sort of points out this was inevitable, effectively, given all the consolidation.
I know, it's it same story again, isn't it? Just really bigger scale. You know, they've got the same line, combining will strengthen our editorial product, the cost savings will help fund growth-focused investments. Peter, you've got a bean counter here.
Yes. Well, I just think I could get very rich making a bean counter BS app that just spits out these stock phrases, a bit like stock photographs, so that ahead of every layoff or closure, they can say, cost savings will fund growth-focused investments, blah, blah, blah. It's just, I get it. I really do get the commercial imperatives, which I think I've said that twice this podcast.
Yeah, I'm going to put it on the bingo card. So, talking of managing expectations then, rumours are swirling that Glamour is going to axe its print issue entirely and go all in on digital. And if you look at what's happening with its kind of sister titles, this actually looks like it, you know, more than a rumour.
Yeah, I think as soon as they appointed Samantha Barry, who is actually absolutely brilliant, but she's not got a print background at all, I think that was almost the sign that they were looking to focus on the digital leadership side of things. I think one thing that threw me a little bit is, I thought Glamour downsized anyway. I thought it was doing a biannual print issue, but no, that was the British Glamour.
Yeah, that was Glamour UK.
So they're actually looking at doing the same thing to Glamour US, or possibly combining the US and UK teams a little bit like they did to Continental Traveller a couple of weeks ago. I mean, it's the same thing. It's cost cutting. It's making efficiencies.
You know what all the titles that we've spoken about in terms of consolidation have in common is that they are, for the most part, very, very mass market, and that there is, yeah, you know, it doesn't matter how much cost you actually take out, you're still in an incredibly crowded space. And to me, it seems like, you know, sure, going digital only with Glamour does make sense. You know, there's huge e-commerce opportunities here. It's at least a way to reduce some of your cost in a non-content specific way. But as we've seen with kind of Time Inc.'s titles, the brand itself isn't enough to guarantee digital sustainability. You know, you can't rely on a magazine's brand anymore to just carry it.
But I think what they're trying to do, you know, the consolidation and this idea of British teams and US teams, I've worked like that, and it works. Mm. You know, you can have people in the States and people in the UK working together and creating content that they can share, and a bit like the Mirror and the Express.
Speaking of all this negative and slightly negative print magazine news, Bauer is launching a new magazine which is dedicated to TV in the 80s.
Hey, I love this. Not the idea of an 80s TV magazine, God forbid. The 80s TV was largely shite, just like 80s pop.
Hey.
Yeah, and this is proper magazine publishing. This is spotting an angle, spotting a need. I think the quote from the editor, whose name I can't remember, he says, nostalgia for the 80s has gone on longer than the 80s, which is brilliant. And they've spotted this information need or this interest, and they're going out and they're making a publication to serve it. It's brilliant. That's what magazine publishing is all about. I don't know what the frequency of this. I don't know if it's a one-off, it's a series.
It's a one-off, but they're looking to do a kind of a series around a similar kind of thing. So it's, I think that's just identified. It reminds me a little bit of kind of the New European. You know, they've got this short-term idea, and who knows, it might actually go somewhere.
Yeah, you don't necessarily need it to last forever for it to be a success. You know, and this is the latest in a long line of Bauer titles that they've launched over the last year. I think this might actually be the fifth one that they've launched, because Pilot TV, which is, you know, their magazine dedicated to cinematic television of the sort you see on Hulu and Netflix, lo and behold, it has become an ongoing title, or at least it's got a second issue. So this is just an experiment, it feels like, and if it finds an audience, then great. If not, it might have made enough to cover its costs and wash its face.
Yeah, brilliant. I love it.
If you haven't listened to it yet, do go back into our archives and listen to our sponsored special on whether advertising is more hassle than it's worth. I spoke to The Drum's Fergus Gregory and Flume Training's Raoul Monks, and we tried to determine whether advertising is now more hassle than it's worth for all the companies that are trying to sustain themselves from it. Some fascinating insights in there. Please do check it out. This week, I spoke to Lucy Kung. She's one of the go-to names for macro and micro industry analysis. She's a visiting fellow at the Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism and has a ton of other roles in the industry that allow her to see a bigger picture that most of us don't have the opportunity to. So we spoke about journalism's perverse relationship with Silicon Valley, and I began by asking her how legacy media has responded to the rise of the new tech giants.
Well, I think there has been huge change inside newsrooms. So what the emergence of the platforms, the advance of the kind of social mobile platform model has done is really kind of accelerate the synthesis of technology and journalism, which has really been the big story in the media over the last 15, 20 years has been the ascendancy of technology. It's gone from being kind of the plumbing, what was needed to kind of for content creators to do their job, to being absolutely integral to creating content, to creativity, to connecting with audiences. And it's really, really evident, I think, now in newsrooms. So one of the things I've been looking at recently is where are those coming together? Where are tech and journalism coming together? And you really see that in relation to the platforms, partly in terms of social media, the fact that social media teams are now in the newsrooms. They started off just kind of being a kind of promotional funnel, I think, and now we're seeing them expanding into being absolutely intrinsic to the business model. I mean, they create a much bigger ocean in which media companies can fish for readers. But we're also seeing kind of new forms of digital storytelling, new formats emerge that will kind of get traction on those social media platforms. And obviously, you know, data, the rise of data is I think, the big story, sub-story in the rise of technology. And that's being driven in part by the platforms and also partly by the shift to subscription-based business models. But I think that really the meta impact of the platforms on the media industry has been strategic. I mean, it's essentially destroyed their business model. It's kicked away a couple of legs of their table, their revenue table. And, you know, it's all looking very, very wobbly and unstable. It's leaning horribly as a result.
Yeah, and I think that, I mean, there's so much to unpack there, but I think the thing to really emphasize is how fast this, you know, this rate of change has been. You know, I'm thinking back to conferences I went to even 3-4 years ago, where people still thought that there was kind of a symbiosis between publisher and platform and that they could really make it work, and where new forms of storytelling digitally were being touted as, you know, these brand new things, but we just take them for granted now.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, if I look back, 2016, I published Innovators in Digital News, and in that book, I looked really hard at The Guardian, BuzzFeed, Vice, and Quartz. I mean, all of them have jumped somersaults since then, but the big story in that book was kind of the rise of the distributed model, and that's now gone. I mean, if you look at the really
fast
shift, it's like 3 years, 2 years. And at that point, that was the great white hope. I mean, everyone was jumping into that field. And you look at these painful twists BuzzFeed is taking now. I mean, it's doing e-commerce, it's announced it's looking at membership. I mean, it really shows that this distributed model based on native advertising revenues cannot fund serious journalism.
So why did it take publishers so long to, A, change to take advantage of distributed publishing? And how are they managing this change back now with these, you know, great legacy tails behind them and these newsroom structures that don't necessarily reflect priorities?
Yeah, I don't think they're changing back. I think it's a kind of continual evolution, but they are very complex beasts. I think that's the problem. I mean, the digital pure plays are pure plays. They started with a clean sheet of paper. They're built for the situation they came into. They can pivot very fast. Legacy players are these monoliths, you know, that still have their mass media activities with printing presses or, you know, broadcast playouts. They have their niche products, they have their online activities, and they have the social mobile. And a lot of these new players are just on the social mobile layer or online social mobile. So these are very big ships to turn around. And a lot of those old businesses are still keeping the lights on. I think that's really still a problem. They can't just jump all in into these new areas. They still need to keep the old areas and the old customers happy.
And when you look at what happens with, you know, even these digital pure plays like The Outline, which, you know, 2 years old, is already seems to be shuttering its long-term publishing strategy. And you think, well, how are these huge, great monolithic companies ever going to be able to adapt, you know, in time to take advantage of, you know, these flash in the pan new revenue streams that the Great White Hope and then gone the next day?
Yeah, and there's a really horrible timing issue here. I mean, what you find is there are couple of really great thinkers, and one of the great thinkers is Andy Grove from Intel, and he had this concept whereby essentially there's a kind of valley you have to get through, moving from the old to the new, and the it's called, you know, the valley of death. And the big challenge is you get across the valley while you've still got really, really solid revenue streams coming in from the old businesses. If you leave it too long and those revenue streams are already contracting, you don't have the money you need to invest in the new business areas. And I think that's really a problem for people that have left it too long to make the jump.
Yeah.
And we're really now beginning to see the companies that have been in this, that have been hacking through it and just trying and trying and trying and trying to solve this problem since, you know, 2002, it's really paying off now. You know, the FT, 16 years into their pay model, they're, you know, hitting a million. The New York Times started a long time ago. It's very difficult to start now. That having been said, I do think they're late mover advantages, ironically, because a lot of this stuff, a lot of the tech you can buy off the shelf, a lot of things have been tried and either proven to work or not work. So you can probably be more focused. But the problem is, if you're trying to make a big, expensive shift now and you don't have the revenues coming in, and that's the position that late movers are kind of in.
But at the same time, they're recognising that with everybody pouring into this market with almost best practice set out for them, competition is going to be increasingly fierce.
Yeah, I mean, we have to be hitting peak subscription. I mean, when I did the last piece of research, the last book, going digital, I took out 8 subscriptions. You know, essentially the company as I was looking at, I experienced them as a user as well. And then when that research was finished, I had to kind of prune, because, you know, you can't actually sustain, no normal income person can sustain 8 subscriptions. And then you get in this ridiculous situation of, you know, is it The Economist or the FT? Is it the Wall Street Journal or is it New York Times? And I think most people are going to hit that. So we are going to hit peak subscription at some point. And I think on top of that, even in a best case scenario, subscriptions are never going to support finance really quality journalism, especially if you want a network of international correspondents. I think that's really a problem. And you can work it out. You can work out your potential total addressable market times the highest possible subscription you could charge. And that's your ceiling, actually. And in most cases, that is never going to cover what you need to finance really substantial journalism. So I think what we will see is a kind of sobering people will sober up in relation to subscriptions.
So I was about to ask, is that a process that you've seen beginning already, just in terms of how publishers are really managing their rhetoric? Or is this a sort of tacit acknowledgement that we're going to see become much more overt and explicit over the next couple of years?
I think we are seeing it indirectly. I mean, I think we're seeing really smart attempts to clean up advertising. I mean, advertising revenue is still there and it's going to be really important in the midterm. So, you know, maximizing what can be taken from the advertising area. I think that's really important. I think in terms of subscriptions, we're seeing this kind of secondary shift, which is from subs into a kind of membership relationship, a la Guardian. I think that's kind of, you know, the new iteration of subs. But I think on top of that, what we are seeing is, again, most people following the same kind of strategy, but looking at new business areas that are somehow adjacent to the old ones. So people media, you know, this big shift to live journalism, events and conferences, which I think is really interesting. And a lot of people are moving in that direction now. E-commerce, affiliate income, that those kind of areas we're seeing more focus on, more kind of systematic, strategic energy put in there. But it's difficult. I mean, these are new businesses and they're not unoccupied fields. It's not as if no one is in the conference space, you know, wait, and it's an empty field waiting for publishers to move into. There are people in there who are going to compete very hard to hold on to the space they've got.
So there's a you know, a huge question about where publishers who have these finite resources can actually choose to kind of spend the money and sort of where they can actually place their bets.
I think so. I mean, I think though, especially as they build up their data capabilities, and especially for legacy quality publishers that do have really, really loyal readers and have, you know, have been important in those readers' lives, I think there is a lot of potential in this field, actually. Where I am more concerned are in the kind of wackier Silicon Valley kind of areas, you know, the inorganic growth, the investing in startups and the innovation labs and so on, because I think that's a really fascinating area. But you know, even Silicon Valley or private equity, and that's all they do, have a pretty low hit rate in this area.
You mentioned the fact that, you know, you almost distrust the term agility as it relates to publishers. I just wondered if you could sort of unpack that for me.
Yeah, I think one of my big messages, especially from the last piece of research I did, is to be really, really careful about what you import from Silicon Valley. Be really judicious about which elements of that philosophy and management style you are seeking to import, because these organizations are operating from an entirely different standpoint, and organizational recipes that work for them are not going to work automatically for legacy. So I think in the industry, especially, you know, worried, tired legacy people, frustrated by inertia, got really seduced by some Silicon Valley concepts like, for example, agile, lean, design thinking, failing fast, and so on. And they are really interesting concepts, really, really important, but for product development, you know, for innovation, they are not strategy tools. And it always feels to me like companies have got kind of drunk on the agile Kool-Aid. You know, it's kind of, and the risk is it's kind of like busy work. It gives this kind of proxy sense of moving forward, of, you know, creating options, but it's not really tackling this enormous strategic problem, this wicked strategic problem, which I think is actually what they, I think that's part of what they should be importing from Silicon Valley.
Is there anybody who you think has taken that agility and product development mentality to heart and is really avoiding the pitfalls?
I think a lot of the smarter players are. I mean, I think in general, the issues that really, really should be imported from Silicon Valley are firstly this fantastic tight forensic focus they have on the businesses they're looking at. You know, what I really love about venture capital organizations, also private equity, is this undiluted focus. What is the problem here? What is this business trying to do? What assumptions are we working on? Are they right? Get the data, clarify the objectives, test them. But looking at strategy, not particular products. And then this focus on execution. You make it happen or you change your plan. And I think what we've seen a lot with legacy is, just as one executive put it to me, and sorry for the language, but, you know, too many chicken soup projects, just hundreds and hundreds of new initiatives floating around everywhere. And that, I think, has been a chronic problem for legacy. It's entirely understandable, but they have got really sucked into this stream of kind of shiny new things. And, you know, frankly, it is an industry also that lives in a bubble. There are so many conferences, so many newsletters, and all of those conferences and newsletters need content. And there's a kind of risk that the new thing gets kind of pushed into being the success formula. You know, moderate successes get inflated into the way out of all of this. I mean, one of the things I loved in the last book the going digital research, I compared, I think, how the FT and the Economist approached Snapchat. Mm. And they both made different decisions that might have changed in the interim. But what was really clear was the intentionality behind those decisions. One jumped onto it, one did not, but they knew exactly what they were trying to get out of it. And the one that didn't jump onto it knew exactly why it didn't fit with current goals. And I think it's that kind of clarity, that reflexivity, that intentionality that's missing.
That's fascinating, because they are both, you know, you've cited both of them before in this podcast as being sort of examples of brands who are really, who have that sense of, you know, their identity and what they're about. But as you mentioned, they are such separate entities now with such different corporate structures and different publishing strategies. So there is a sort of a kernel there that, as long as you kind of know your identity and you know your worth, you know, and who your audience is, that maybe things might come right as long as you don't just throw everything at the wall and see what sticks. It's almost a kind of a hopeful message.
I think it is. I mean, I think the more time you can devote to these really wicked strategic problems, the better, actually. And the more you can simplify. It's very, very easy. And again, I think this is a dangerous byproduct, this kind of agile approach. It's very easy to start things up. It's very easy to shut things. It's very hard to shut things down. And organizations can really freak out if you shut things down. They begin to think, you know, the writing's on the wall. This is, you know, the beginning of the end. And actually, in the current environment, it makes a lot of sense. So I think it's really important to kind of desensitize organizations to exits. This is what has to happen in the current environment. It's not the beginning of the end.
To go back to the analogy you used earlier, kind of this valley of death, do you think that most of the media companies who have, you know, transitioned back to, or rather transitioned across to membership-based models, subscription-based models, have actually, for the most part, made their way, you know, through that valley, and we're sort of waiting for other people to catch up?
Well, I think it's clearly a really intelligent strategy. It's just a really expensive strategy. I mean, that's the problem. And it's not, again, go back to the FT, 16 years. I mean, it takes a long time for that to pay off. And it's difficult to be doing that when everyone else is doing it at the same time. So I think we are seeing a lot of successes. I mean, in that respect, I do find the Scandinavian markets kind of fascinating. We talked about this in our kind of prep phone call, but, you know, that... They're small markets with exotic languages, very strong public service broadcasters as competitors, but nonetheless, they're making this work, which is one of the reasons I spend a lot of time researching over there. I mean, I think there are solutions, but normally you do find part of it is being quite systemic and being very focused on what you're trying to do, and then communicating that, getting that accepted by the newsroom, by the content creators, is really, really important. And then you start coming into the kind of human side of this, which another finding from our research is that's really under-indexed, how important it is and how incredibly difficult it is to do it well. You know, the big surprise from the going digital research was how much time I spent essentially on HR, which I never expected to. It's, you know, it's kind of something that makes lips curl and eyebrows, you know, eyeballs roll. But it's really, really central. I mean, media industry traditionally does not really do management. It's never really taken running itself well as organizations as a particularly important thing. And often there's a kind of even anti-managerial bias. I think partly because of the separation between business areas and journalistic areas. But I think it's really dangerous. I mean, another thing to take from Silicon Valley is this enormous emphasis they put on building the right culture, on ensuring they've got the right talent, on making sure that talent is happy, on having a very transparent culture, on communicating very well. And that's really, really important, I mean, to ensure that you are going to implement your strategy, I think. So I think the people side of this transition has received a lot of attention. People are very concerned about it, but it kind of needs to go up the agenda. Okay, well, if you're into Silicon Valley and Silicon Valley dysfunction, two fantastic books this year, Bad Blood by John Carreyrou on Theranos. Fantastic. And then actually even more powerful is Reset by Ellen Powell. And Ellen Powell was, if you remember that, she was the venture capitalist who sued Kleiner Perkins.
Yep.
And she's with the great, I mean this in the nicest possible way, she's not a great writer. It's a very dry, very analytic, very objective analysis of what happened. From that point of view, it's even more powerful, I think, than Bad Blood.
Don't forget, you can check out our back catalogue of more than 70 previous episodes of Media Voices. We spoke to Samantha Barry, who we mentioned earlier on, and a bunch of other people who have deep, deep insight into what's going on in the media. Additionally, you can keep in touch with us at Media Voices Pod on Twitter, or follow us individually, you'll find us.
And don't forget, you can also sign up to the newsletter for everything from what we're reading, and In Our Own Words section on this week's interview, all the stories we've talked about this week, a quote of the week, and much, much more. So if you're already on the list and like it, please forward it to somebody else. Until next week, when we're going to be back... Oh, in fact, next week we're going to be back with our live special. How are you feeling about the very first live episode?
I'm excited and a little bit terrified.
Yeah, but I mean... I think it was Katy Perry who said that she still gets nervous going on stage. So, I mean, we're not even as good as Katy Perry, let's be honest. So.
I'm about my firework.
But until next week, we're going to be back with Katy Perry's Firework. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.
Bye.